I must have this thing. And I'd like to introduce Sarah. It's going to be our speaker tonight from Midtown Group.
Hi, my name's Sarah. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sarah.
You don't have to worry about speaking.
Okay. All right. I have a sobriety date. It's May 28th of 2013. Jenny R. is my sponsor. Midtown is my home group. And I have the privilege of sponsoring other women in this program. And I love doing things like this because it helps me stay sober. And I love that that reading that you just read talks about establishing a relationship with God. And I think that, you know, it talks about in the big book, you know, people might struggle with it, but it says God a lot in here. And for a long time, I think that that's what I was trying to find while I was drinking. And it was just a connection with something that was greater than myself. And I couldn't do it because I was drinking and I was blocked. And, you know, I'll just start off, you know, telling you what happened, what it was like and what it's like now. And then I'll kind of just go through the journey of my experience with the steps and how I apply them in my life today. I was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and to a family of six kids. I'm five out of six. And my mother and father got married when they were really young. And, you know, my dad is a hard worker, and my mom, for, you know, the most portion, you know, a large portion of you know, me, for me growing up, was taking care of a lot of kids. And, you know, that kept my mom busy a lot. But one thing that my mom has and my father has on both sides is alcoholism. And a good friend of mine always says that alcoholism doesn't run in my family, it gallops. And that is definitely the truth about my family. There isn't not one of us that isn't touched by this thing. And, you know, I can tell you that I would do things when I was little. My father would watch football. We moved down to Atlantic City when I was about six, and my dad worked in the casinos. He's a chef, and he would have his Sundays and his Mondays off, and he would watch the Philadelphia Eagles play. And he would, you know, we had the refrigerator downstairs, and he would say, "Sarah, can you go grab me a beer out of the refrigerator? I'll give you 50 cents." I never got that 50 cents, by the way. Never. He owes me a lot of money. That man, he does. But I would go and I would crack open the can for him, and it would foam, and I would take the little sip off of it, and every single time I would be like, "Ugh, that's so gross," but I still drank it, and it didn't. I don't think it did anything to me, but it was just always there. Alcohol was always there, you know. And as you know, growing up, my aunts and uncles would come. We lived down on the shore in Atlantic City, and they come on the weekends during the summertime, and you know, bring their cases in Miller Lite, and, you know, and be at a pool, and, you know, Friday, Saturday nights, they would, you know, drink, listen to, you know, music, and they looked like they were having a good time, that something was happening to them, and I just remember, it was fun, it was exciting. They would play, like Motown music, and my dad was a good singer, and my uncle and him would sing, and they would play pool, and then by like one or two, my dad would have went to sleep. My mom would have probably gotten into my mom would have gotten into a fight with her sister. Craziness would happen, you know, yelling this, that, and the other. Everybody would go to bed. Maybe the cops would be called. Who knows, you know? Then we would wake up in the morning, and it would be like, "Do you want Rice Krispies or Cheerios?" You know, and it was never any talk of that, you know. But it looked fun to me, you know. And I remember I would go outside during the school year, and I would see this airplane like fly across every night, every day, like 3:30. It would like fly across the sky, and I would watch it, and I would get like this melancholy feeling of like, where's that airplane going, and who's on that airplane, and what are they doing? And I was like, if I could only be older, I could be on that airplane, and I could do all these fun things. I never wanted to be six. I always wanted to be 26, you know, and I never wanted to be 12. I always wanted to be 35, you know, like I always wanted to be older. And I definitely can you know, they talk about anxious apartness in the big book, and they talk about alcoholic loneliness. And I remember when I first heard those terms, I remember just glimpses of when I was little. I don't know, I would just, it would be, you know, I'd be brushing my hair in the mirror, and all of a sudden I'd just catch, lock eyes with myself, and it would be this deep sinking feeling of emptiness for maybe 10 seconds or 15 seconds, and it was just this hole that I felt. And I didn't know what that was, you know? I hate it. I can remember the feeling, and I remember telling my sponsor about that. She's like, that's the alcoholic loneliness that we talk about, you know? And I needed a drink, like, a long time before I had one. And I started drinking around the age of 12. And, you know, they used to make Gatorade, and they had those glass bottles of Gatorade. And I remember filling the Gatorade bottle up of whiskey, leaving it in the shed in the backyard, and I would go out and play basketball, and then I would just sneak a little sip of this whiskey, you know? And it would make me feel really warm. It would calm me down after school. And my mom, like, found it after a little while, and she's like, what is this? Is this yours? Are you drinking this? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, what are you, you're just, like, drinking whiskey in the backyard? Like, what? And I was like, yeah, you know? Like, it's kind of, you know? And she's just like, I just remember that there wasn't any type of consequences, you know? I was number 5 out of 6 kids. My mom had already been through a lot with her older ones, you know, and they were off to college. And I think that she kind of was, like, starting to – she went back to school, you know. My mom was, like, jack of all trades. She's the hardest working woman, you know. She always, you know, she always pushed herself. She just – she can do anything, but she's also an alcoholic, you know. And – I just never got into a lot of trouble with that, you know. And it was 7th or 8th grade, I think I didn't really fit in. The only thing that ever really got me through the school day was that, or, you know, just anything really. I mean, I was a good student, you know, smart. I was a really good athlete. You know, and I was picked probably first before the guys sometimes. I could play baseball, basketball, field hockey, soccer, anything. I was good at it. But I would get this, like, this nervousness that just, I couldn't stand it, you know. I was so good at it, but, like, before a game, I was just, like, anxiety. Like, I didn't want to do it. Once I was out there, I was okay, but it was, like, this buildup, you know, and this feeling, you know. It was just so self-centered. I cared so much about what everybody thought of me, you know, and I played in, you know, I was a varsity, you know, always varsity, no matter where I was at. And I had started drinking, you know, 6th, 7th grade, and then into my 8th grade year, I had made a group of friends, and, you know, we kind of started, experimenting with different, substances, and moving forward into my 9th grade year of high school. I remember it was basketball. It was like I was going to play basketball that year, and my mom. I don't think I told her when the tryouts were, but I knew that they were like on a Thursday, and I just didn't tell her, and I didn't go. And like I was like supposed to be playing. Like the coach was like, I was on the team. I just needed to show up, and I was like so scared, you know, of doing this. You know, it was just different people. It was high school, like, that high school was, like, a really good basketball team, and I was just really scared. And, like, that Friday, I was in my homeroom, and the basketball coach came into there, and he was like, come here. And he's like, why, you weren't at practice, you weren't at the tryouts. And I was like, well, I don't think I'm going to play. And he's like, no, you will play. And I was like, you know, he's like, you're going to go home and tell your mom, you know, and you will play. And, so I went home and told my mom, and she was so mad at me because she knew I remember just saying like, what is wrong with you? Like, you're so scared of everything all the time. Like what, you know? And I was really, really scared and fearful of a lot of things, you know? And she was like, you know, you just play this one season. And if you don't like it, you don't ever have to play again. And I said, okay. And I went and, you know, I went back to the coach, and he was like, well, because you didn't, I can't just, like, put you on the varsity team. You didn't come to the tryout. So we're going to put you on the junior varsity team, and then we'll see where that goes. And I played that season, and, like, we went undefeated. And, you know, I didn't really connect with any of the people that were on the team. And I had these other kind of, like, seedy friends that I was, you know, getting in the mix of. And it was our last game. It was a championship game. And we played – like 15 seconds left, and I know this is like a cheesy, you know, like every school movie that I'm about to, but I got fouled, and it was like we were down by 2 points, and I got fouled trying to take a 3-point shot, so I got 3 foul shots. So I like needed to make all these 3 foul shots, and then we would have won the game, or at least if we could whittle the time down that 15 seconds, we would have won. So I sunk the first one, I sunk the second one, and I sunk the third one. And we won that basketball game. And after, all these people came up to me and they patted me on the back and they told me what a great job I did. And, you know, all, you know, hooray, hooray. And I'm thinking, like, I'm never going to play another game of basketball again in my life, because what if I hadn't made those shots? None of you would have come up to me and said anything. I would have been a really big disappointment to you, you know, so I won't try anymore. And I had something waiting for me that day after that game that, basically I crossed into another, you know, I crossed over and I was on my way to not, I could never go back, you know? And, you know, I stopped playing sports, got involved with a lot of, you know, I always say that I got involved in the wrong crowd, but I think that I was the wrong crowd. I always say that, you know? And, you know, we started doing things that, you know, that I don't know, you know, we talk about, you know, like promising ourselves that we would never do these things, but like yet, you know, just lowering the bar like down and, you know, I'm at 15 years old and I have like a fake ID. I'm at 15. I mean, I'm 39 right now and I think I look pretty young. So imagine me at the age of 15, you know, probably look like a 9-year-old. And we would go to this town in right outside Atlantic City called Pleasantville, New Jersey, and it's not very pleasant to be in. And there was a liquor store that sold us honey browns and whiskey and anything that we wanted. And one day I got this bright idea. I you know, mind you, I still went to church every Sunday. You know, I did all that. I believed in God. Like I think deep down I wanted to be good. I would do anything to get a drink at this point. And, my friend and I decided that, you know, the buses weren't running or something like that. And we were like, maybe we could take your mom's Thomas English muffin bread truck that's parked outside because the keys are here. And she's like, what a good idea. So I mean, when I say this is a truck like that you see on the road, you know, and brightest idea that we ever had. And so I don't have a license, I don't know how to drive. She thinks she knows how to drive, but she doesn't. And it's stick shift, and we get in there, and it's got the bread in there. I mean, you know, we're like ready for delivery. And that we're getting to the liquor store on a Sunday at 10 o'clock. And we got halfway there, stalled out, all the bread's flying around, you know. And I'm like, I think that we're going to need to ditch this car, and we're going to have to try and find another ride because we're not making it there in this car. So we found another ride, and we make it to liquor store. We get the liquor, we get all the stuff, we put it in the back seat of my friend's car, and this was in the 90s, and he was like one of these people that went to like Grateful Dead shows and fish shows and stuff like that. And he had just gotten back from a fish tour, and this little Ford Escort had a leaking seat, like a leaking what is it called, the sunroof. And it had leaked for like 2 months, and he like hadn't taken a shower for probably 3 months, and it was just, the car was disgusting. And so we get the liquor and we put it in the back seat and throw over a blanket, and he goes to pull out, and I look over and he cut off a cop that just got off work. And I just remember locking eyes with the cop, and he was like, pull over now. You know, he pointed at his badge on his arm, and I'm like, oh my God, you know, like, we should have just taken the bread truck, you know, we would have made it here, you know, like, we had more of a chance. And so we pull over into a Baptist church that just got out, and 10 cop cars show up, and they ask us if there's anything illegal in this car, and we adamantly said no. And And they said, you realize that if there's anything in this car, y'all are going to jail. And we were like, no, there's nothing in the car. You could search it. And he opened the car up, and whatever disgusting filth of, like, just came out of that car. He turned and he said, you sure there's nothing in this car? And we were like, yep. And he said, well, if there is, y'all can have it, because I'm not even going to go in there. And he goes, we're going to tow your car because your insurance is expired, and it's going to be right around the corner. You need to pay $50, and you need to get this. So anything, I would have gone to any lengths. You know, we paid that $50. We got that car, and I got drunk that night, you know. And that's where I was at 15 years old, you know. And I had gotten in trouble a little time after that, and my mother was like, all right, this is it. I'm going to send you, you know, you're either going to go away to rehab or you're going to go to AA. And I said, well, I'll go to AA. And, you know, 15, 16, I was introduced to you all. And I sat in meetings, and I didn't realize that when they gave chips out for 30 days, that meant that was in a row. So I would pick a 30-day chip up, but it might take me 3 months to get that 30 days, because if I didn't drink for 3 days in a week, well, that was 3 days, you know, and that's where my adolescent mind was, you know. It took me a while to figure that out. But the people in those meetings talked about, they talked about the steps, and they talked about, you know, the inventory, and they talked about the ninth step, and they talked about God and how their lives had literally fallen apart, and how they were doing okay now because they stopped drinking and they developed a connection with God, and that, you know, they got a sponsor, and that they were applying this program of action into their lives. I did get that because, you know, they talked about, you know, going to jail and getting out, you know, they talked about losing their houses, you know, going bankrupt, losing their children. But they seemed like something was different, you know, that had happened to them, and that they had changed their lives, and that those things had started to come back just by one day at a time not drinking. But at that time, I thought, well, I'm not an alcoholic. I think I just need to get better at not getting caught, and, you know, I'm too young for this. But, you know, I think that God places you in certain situations, and, you know, you can either... You know, I mean, at that time, I think I was right where I was supposed to be. You know, if I could have stopped then, I would have, but that's just not my story. And, you know, time went on, and I graduated from high school. And, you know, I thought, all right, well, everybody's going away, and maybe I should move. And I ended up moving to California. And I thought, all right, when I go to California, I'm gonna stop drinking. I'm gonna stop using the drugs. I'm gonna maybe get a job. You know, just change. You know, maybe I'll go back to church, whatever. And I went there and I found the same type of people that I was hanging out with. They were able to get me what I needed, and it was the exact same thing. And then I thought, well, maybe I will move to Hawaii. You know, Hawaii is an island and it's sunny and. It's beautiful and it's paradise. Maybe if I go there, then, you know, I could, maybe I'll do it differently when I go to Hawaii. And it was worse, you know, because everywhere I go, there I am, you know, I am the problem. And I didn't know that then, and lived in Hawaii for a little while and thought, well, maybe I'll move back to New Jersey and maybe I'll try and go to school. I don't know. I just needed something. And I had worked in a bakery out in Hawaii for a little while, and I come from a family, culinary background. I thought, well, I'll move back to New Jersey and then maybe do something with culinary. My dad helped me get into school or something like that. And he helped me get into a school, a really, really good culinary school in New York. And I think that I had inside of me decided maybe I'm going to burn this down before I have to actually be responsible. And it was like 3 or 4 months of pure, I mean, it was like a living hell. And I was right back in with these people. You know, I was hanging out in penthouses in Philadelphia with drug dealers. You know, I was just in situations that I, you know, a 20-year-old kid shouldn't be in. And, you know, if I had gotten caught for any of them, you probably have a different speaker today. And I just remember it was the straw kind of that, you know, broke the camel's back with that. The bottom was that we were in Philadelphia. I was with a bunch of people, and they had rented a few hotel rooms. And we had spent, like, maybe 3 or 4 days just drinking and using. And something came to me, you know, after I had woken up for a little while, and I walked into this room full of – we were kids, you know. And I was with my best friend, and I cared about her so much. And I know she cared about me, and I'm like, how can we do this together? We've known each other since we were 12. You know, I don't want this for you in your life, and I'm sure you don't want this for me. I just didn't know how to stop, you know. And I was like, I'm leaving, and I'm going to leave you here, you know. And she said, okay. And she handed me a wad of cash, a bag of Valium, a knife, and a cell phone. And this was like in the later 90s, and I didn't know how to even use that cell phone. I'm like, just give me a quarter, I'll use a payphone, you know. And I called a cab, and it took me to the train station, and I went back down to Atlantic City, and then I decided that I didn't know how to stop any of this, and then I was going to kill myself. And the next day, I took my car out to this long strip of road in Atlantic City, and it was like, you know, a barren road out in the marsh, and it was really cold. It was in February, and it was real icy, and I thought, well, if I get my car up to about 100 miles an hour, and I just jerk the wheel, I'll flip this car into that water, and it'll look like an accident, and maybe it won't hurt so bad for when they find me. They might think that I didn't kill myself, you know. And I got the car up to 100 miles an hour, and I just said to myself, I remember just saying, like, God, if you're there, can you just please help me? I don't know what it was that day, but it was freezing in my car. I didn't have heat, and that car got really, really warm. And I felt like the sun just opened up in the sky, and I stopped the car, and I got out. And I, for the first time in years, I felt what I think was a surrender, and I could breathe just a little bit. And I thought, maybe this isn't how my life has to be. And I took a minute, and I just appreciated the quiet. And I drove to a church, and I walked in, and I prayed, and I asked God for help. And, you know, I'd like to say that, you know, I quit, and, you know, life got better after that. But really what happened was is that God allowed a little bit of time for me to just straighten myself up and get me out of that element. And I ended up going up to school, and I thought, all right, maybe I'll go back to those meetings. Definitely think that I have a drug problem. I don't think I have a drinking problem. It's never been the drinking. It's always been drugs. Maybe I'll go see a therapist and talk to a therapist about some things that have been on my mind. Maybe I'll go back to church. And I did all of those little things, and it made me feel better. But what happened is that I, after a little while at school, you know, I stopped drinking. I had a planner, and it was like, you know, I would put like day one, day two, and I counted my days. You know, 120 days, 130 days. And, you know, I wasn't drinking and I wasn't using drugs, you know. And I thought, well, I can control this and I can do this. And what happened for me is that, you know, if I don't do this program, and I know it now, that I really have no defense against the first drink. And I ended up meeting somebody and falling in love, and they would become my higher power for the next 7 years. And I, again, you know, thought, well, I don't use the drugs. This person knew that I had a problem with drugs and alcohol, but I said, well, talk to him about it. And, you know, he was aware of that, you know, but I kind of convinced myself that I'm in culinary school. I have to drink because I have to taste wine. You know, I have to pair food with wine. You know, this is what I do in restaurants. And I started drinking after probably about a year and a half. And, you know, I'm an alcoholic. And when I drink, you know, I mean, at that point, you know, I never drank there was never a time where I had one glass of wine. When I drank, I got drunk all the time. I just didn't think that it was a problem. And when I, you know, moved out, I got a job with the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Group, and I moved down to Washington, D.C., and I'm, like, working for a great hotel group with great chefs, and I'm working hard. And I'm a good worker, you know. I'm getting promoted really quickly, up, making more money. Clearly, I don't have a drinking problem. And with that business, it's like, that's what you do. You drink, you know, and you get off work and you get a couple beers. And, you know, but what happened for me is that relationship started to, you know, go south. That it was, we were horrible for each other. We became each other's higher power. I made some pretty bad decisions, financially, that kind of tied me to them. And, I just was miserable. And I remember being at a party one night, and I don't know, I was drinking, and somebody had some other outside substances, and I thought, I'm gonna try that again. It's been years now. I'm gonna try that again, and I tried that, and it was like the perfect concoction that just went. And I'm like, why did I ever stop any of this? And it was just like that again. I mean, I wanted to get on a train and go back to Atlantic City. I wanted to go gambling. The whole life I wanted back, you know. And I didn't know that. Now I know I'm an alcoholic. I know that, you know, like the phenomenon of craving, it was there and it always has been. And I talked about, you know, that meeting those meetings I used to go to when I was a kid. And, talk about, if you drink long enough, you will have consequences, you know, and, relationship, lost it, house, lost it, drinking in my car after work, you know, miserable, suicidal, you know, doom and gloom, and drunk driving, you know, just the whole, you know, the whole cycle is back again. And, in this time, and I talked about my mom being an alcoholic, and my mom, she started drinking very heavily. And my sister, my younger sister, she's a recovered heroin addict. And at this time, she was in full-blown addiction. And so my mom was drinking herself to death, and my sister was, you know, shooting dope, you know, in bathrooms in Atlantic City. And, you know, they both kind of played off of each other. And I'm sitting here watching, like, my family just fall apart. And then my relationship ended, house, like, I mean, not, I had nothing good happening. 2009 was a bad year. And, I don't know what happened, but my mom decided she was going to quit drinking. And she thought, like, maybe she might lose her daughter, you know, her younger daughter and my sister, but she wasn't going to lose herself. You know, she needed to take care of herself. So my mom started going to AA, and, she talked to me about it, you know, that she knew that she was an alcoholic and that she had, you know, that she wanted to stop drinking. And she, you know, my mom started getting some time under her belt. And then, you know, eventually my little sister had a couple warrants out for her arrest, and she was facing, I think she had like 5 felonies in court, and she was incarcerated. And honestly, it was like the best time, I think, for my mom and you know, our family, because we knew where she was and she was safe in jail. And in this whole time, I'm like thinking, well, I'm not doing that, you know. I can drink, you know. I'm not doing that stuff. And all I was doing was just drinking and drinking and drinking, you know. And it was such a hard time. I was telling a friend of mine, I was like, if I didn't have alcohol then, I would be dead right now. If I didn't, that was my solution then. It was the only way I could cope and get up out of bed in the morning, you know. And I mean, so overwhelming, you know. And what happened was my mom got sober, and she started to go to AA, and she got a sponsor, and she started to work the steps, and she started changing, and I saw that she started changing. And then my little sister, she was able to get into a program, and she was placed in a women's home, and she started to work her own program, and she got clean, and her life started to get put back together. And those were two miracles that they, in my opinion, they have no business being alive today. you know, there before the grace of God, you know, that's, I mean, I watched that. And I would call them, and I was hitting a major bottom myself. And there was absolutely nothing wrong in my life. 3 or 4 years had gone by, and I was working at a restaurant I was the executive chef at. I made really good money. I had a really nice apartment in Georgetown, D.C. I was being flown to Iceland to cook in competitions. I was being flown out to California to cook wine dinners. People really looked up to me, but I went home every night and I wanted to die. And I would drink myself to death, and I would drink and drink and drink. And all I wanted to do was get back to that time when I was 13 years old and how I felt when I was 13 years old, you know, and I could not get back to that drunk, you know. And I would wake up in the morning, and whatever was left in the refrigerator, I would finish because I was shaky. And I would brush my teeth, and I would put my clothes on, and I would walk to work. And then I would have my coffee with my whiskey, and I would be calm till noon. And then I would have a little bit more to drink, and I just, that was my life for years. And, you know, my mom and sister never said, like, you know, we think you have a problem. You know, they would just, I would call them. I would talk to them a little bit about what was going on with me. They would talk to me. I would, you know, they would tell me about the steps in the program. And I would ask questions because I knew what a sponsor was. I knew what the steps were. I'd been there. I would ask them, like, about the fourth step and be like, what does this exactly mean? You know, like, okay, so like you're like, how do you do it? You know, and they explained to me a little bit. So it was like that attraction, not promotion. They never said like, we really think you have a problem. It was just, I was interested, you know, and we have the same thing. So it was that bond that you have, you know, when you take out a newcomer or you meet somebody, that bond that you have, it's that language of the heart, you know? And eventually what happened was, I couldn't get drunk anymore. You know, I drank so much that I could not shut my head off. It still kept going. And I'm like, no matter what I put in my body, no matter what I did, it would not stop. And I thought, maybe I'm going crazy. You know, I'm thinking they're going to put me in an institution because, I mean, the voices were like so loud. It was like a train. And, you know, it was like that May 27th was the last night that I drank. And I was at the owner of the restaurant's house. It was Memorial Day weekend, and she had anything you wanted, you know. And my last drink, and I'm pretty proud to say this, is that there's a drink in Iceland. It's their. If you go into a bar, they pour it, and it's called the Black Death, and it's their shot. You know, like certain places have Grand Marnier, certain places have Jägermeister. Well, they have Black Death, and I was like, well, I couldn't get drunk anymore, and I saw Black Death, and I was like, that's what I want. And I went and I opened that up, and I started drinking it that night, and I just still couldn't get drunk. And I went home that night. I looked at myself, and it was like, this is never going to get any better. I woke up the next day, went to work, and I was like so shaky that day. I hadn't had a drink in the morning. I went home and I called my mom, and I told her what was really going on, the truth. And she said, well, it sounds like you have an alcohol problem. You know, maybe you want to go to some meetings or something. You know, is there a meeting around there? And I'm like, meetings? Like, if I say I'm an alcoholic, like, how? Like, what does that mean for me? And, like, what? Like, I can't drink anymore. And I couldn't imagine my life without, alcohol. How was I going to celebrate? How was I going to, you know, mourn? How was I going to just go to the grocery store? You know, how was vacation going to happen? My life had just revolved around that. And, and she said, Sarah, you know, why don't you, hang the phone up with me and go into your refrigerator and just pour out all the booze that you have. And, you know, and just go to a meeting. And I was like, okay. And I hung the phone up and I opened it up, my refrigerator up, and I was like, why don't I just finish all this and then I'll do that, you know? Mm-hmm. And I actually heard what I said, why don't I just drink all this? And I was like, man, it's never going to be the same. You know, I have a major problem here. And I did pour everything out, and I didn't go to a meeting that night. I waited 2 days, and I mean, crazy. I don't know how I made it to work. You know, I mean, it was bad. And, it was a Friday night, and I was laying in my bed, and, I remember staring into the bathroom, and I knew there was a meeting at 7 o'clock around the corner from my house. And I remembered the feeling that day that I had in the car, years ago. And when I asked God for help, And that feeling got me out of my bed, and it took me into the shower, and I took a shower, and I put my clothes on, and I opened my door up. I walked down the street, and as I'm walking down the street, all my brain's telling me, turn around, you can do this tomorrow. Turn around, you can do this tomorrow. But I just kept going. And as I'm walking, there are these two really, like, beautiful women that are walking in front of me, and I'm thinking, I wonder what those two beautiful women are doing tonight. They're all dressed up. They're probably going out tonight. You know, they look, like, so happy. You know, I wish I could be like them. And my brain's telling me this. And as they are walking, I know that I need to make that left. And they made that left right up the stairs, and they went into that AA meeting that day. And they're actually two of my very good friends today. Is it odd or is it God? I don't know. But I walked into a meeting. I walked into that meeting, and I was like, I picked the seat out, and I went right to the seat, and I sat down. And as soon as I sat down, a woman turned around, and she said, hi, my name's Jenny. Have you been to this meeting before? And I was like, no. She was like, why don't you sit down next to me? And she did exactly what we're supposed to do here. She knew that I looked scared. She'd never seen me before, and she introduced herself to me. And I sat down, and I remember her saying to me, what's brought you to this meeting? And I remember kind of like mumbling. I mumbled, it's because I'm really tired. And she said, I didn't hear you. And I remember locking eyes with her, and I said, I'm just really tired. And she put her arm on my shoulder, and she said, well, you're right where you're supposed to be. And I ask new people that today, because sometimes you just, that's a good answer, you know. It's a really good answer, because some people say, I got a DUI, you know, I just need to get this court slip signed, and you know, and it's just, you never know. Like, and it's always like seconds and inches. Like, if she hadn't turned around and said hello to me that day, maybe I would have not gone back. Maybe it would have been good enough. I don't know, you know, but I was dying of alcoholism. And she got my number right away. And in that meeting, they do this thing where they go around the room, and you have to introduce, everybody introduces themselves. So they say what their name is, if they have a sponsor, if they have a home group, and their sobriety date. And then they say you always have the option to pass. And it's a big meeting. There's probably about 100 people in there. And I was the fourth person. And I was like, he said I could pass. So it got to me, and I was like, pass. And I felt like the whole room just, they knew. That I was like, man, these people are coming after me after this meeting. I know how this works. But that woman got my number that day. And she got my number that day. And she picked me up the next day. And she took me to a meeting. Before the meeting, she told me a little bit about her story. And what she told me, I believed. Because that woman was definitely not the person in the story anymore. And we sat down, and I got my 24-hour chip. And I was so scared to call myself an alcoholic. But the night before, they had talked about the third tradition, which the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. So I was like, just knowing that I had a desire to stop drinking was good enough for me for that 24 hours. And I think that's such an important tradition that we have, because it just means you can sit here and figure it out for yourself, you know, just sit here and listen. And I went to the meeting, got my 24-hour chip, picked it up, and I said I was an alcoholic that night. I was like, you know, and I've held on to that chair so tight ever since, you know. She drove me home. It was a long car ride home. And I just remember her, she kept saying, like, I was telling her all these things. You know, I just hadn't talked to anybody in a long time. I had a lot of things to say. I was like angry at this, upset about this. And why did this have to happen to me? And I just hadn't talked to anybody in a long time. And I felt like she understood. And I just remember she kept saying, like, you need to get a sponsor. You really should get a sponsor. You should get a sponsor. And I heard, like, you really need to get a sponsor right now. You need a sponsor. Like, I heard it. It was like this monstrous voice. And I'm like, why? Calm down, lady. So I asked her to be my sponsor. She's been my sponsor to this day. She's still my sponsor. And I remember telling her a little bit about the hate that I had in my heart and the anger that I had, you know, and that how I hated so deeply, and that when I looked at myself, I knew it wasn't normal for a human being to hate, you know, for all the things that had happened and all the way that I had been, you know, I really didn't like myself. And, you know, I think it's you know, in my sponsorship family, you know, we do like definitions, and she, you know, my sponsor really, really, it's very important for us to know the big book, because that day, you know, I told her about how I couldn't stand to hate deeply. And she said right away, there's a book in the back seat. Why don't you pull that up? And it was a 12 and 12. And she said, turn to page 92. And I want you to go down to paragraph 4, and I want you to read that paragraph to me. And in that paragraph, it talked about the alcoholic and how we cannot stand to hate deeply. And I thought, well, maybe this might work, you know. So I started to do the steps, and very quickly with her. And I did a 4-step in my third month of sobriety, because everything started coming back to me. You know, I was calling her, and I was just, I mean, I was like, in the fifth grade, this person did, you know, I mean, it was like stuff I had, like stuff I hadn't thought about in forever, you know, like, and she's like, we just got to get you to the 4-step, got to get you there, Sarah. So I did it, and I did the best that I could, you know, I did the best I could in that 4-step, and I've done many, many, you know, after that, you know, but it was enough, and, you know, and I couldn't believe that I was sitting across from somebody that I had barely known, but I had trusted so deeply at this point, you know, just in the short period of time. I felt like she understood me, and I felt like she cared about me, and I felt like she loved me, you know, and she wanted more for me to be sober, you know. She cared more about what I was doing than how I was feeling, and, you know, we moved into step 6 and 7, and those steps for me to this day clearly, and I'm sure many of you can, you know, attest that I have to use step 6 and 7 every day, because, you know, it talks about removing, you know, what's that definition of removing? It means just to take and place somewhere else. So if I remove, you know, my intolerance, I can have my intolerance, you know, it might not be there in the morning, but it can certainly be back in the afternoon. You know, I can remove this and place this book over there. It's still right there. I can take them back whenever I want, you know, and I had a really hard time. I didn't understand it. I didn't understand step 6 and 7, you know. It's like we made a list of all these defects of the blueprint of what made Sarah up, you know. I'd lived my life for 32 years, and this is how I lived, and now you're telling me that I have to live this way, you know. You're telling me that I'm self-sufficient, and then I got to ask for help now. Like, I got it, you know. You're telling me, like, you know, you're dishonest about these things, and now you have to be honest. Like, that worked for me for a long time, you know. And my sponsor always says that God removes the defects that are going to kill us first, and I wanted to keep them so badly. I wanted them. They were so comfortable, and it was hard for me to let them go, you know. But I moved into step 8, and you know, sometimes you look at step 8 and you're just like, okay, well, you know, we make a list of all these people, you know, and like we become willing to make amends to them all, you know, and all right, just making a list, you know, a lot of work has to come before you make a list, and then you're going to go to step 9 and actually sit in front of these people that you have harmed and, you know, apologize to them and tell them that you have changed and that you are going to act differently now, because that means that you have to do it, you know, you have to do it, you know, because the neutrality happens in step 10, you know, the neutrality between me and alcohol. So I don't want to drink again. I don't ever want to drink again, you know. And, you know, in step 8, I've read that step in the 12 and 12, and the last sentence of that step says, this is the beginning of the end of isolation between God and our fellows. And what a beautiful, beautiful promise that is, you know, because I've always wanted God, and I see God in other people, you know. I see God in other people. When I say the third step, you know, it tells me, you know, like, you know, relieve me of the bondage of self, and I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those that I would help. So I have to help people. I had that, like, my sobriety relies on my other-centeredness, you know. And I didn't realize that for a long time in sobriety. I wanted a lot of things in my first, you know, I was helping people, you know, I was doing all kinds of things. I did anything that she told me, but really, really succumbing to the third step, you know, and, you know, my 9th step, I started to do those amends, and they started to become, I started to get some relief from them. So I relaxed a little bit, you know. I'm like, all right, I'm feeling good. You know, I didn't go like gung ho and let me get them all done. And thank God for some of them, you know. I you know, I did an amends. I wrote an amends out my second year that I never mailed off. And it was probably one of the biggest amends that I had. And it was to my best friend, who I had been best friends with for a large portion of my life. And in that very hard time that I spoke about in 2009, her mother died of alcoholism. And they found her in her apartment, and she had drank herself to death. She had bled to death. Her organs just completely gave out. And, you know, I just thought, there's a lot going on in my life right now, and I don't think that I could handle this. I couldn't be a friend to her, you know? I just couldn't. And I beat myself up over that for a long time. I drank over that. And, you know, I wanted to make amends to her, but, like, the last kind of words that she said to me, and I know that this was out of pain, was that, you know, you've hurt me so badly that I wouldn't care if you died or not, whether you lived or died, Sarah. You know, I just don't want you in my life anymore. And, yeah, those words hurt a lot. But I wrote the amends my second year. I never sent it. And I thank God that I didn't, that I didn't send it, because I, two and a half years later, when I had around 4.5 years, I was in a really, really bad state in my sobriety. I hit another bottom. You know, it was like, I was going to have to really do this. I was going to have, this is going to be my way of living for the rest of my life. And I had to make that decision. And I started to look again at my fears. I started to look again at the amends, and that amends was still sitting there. And I opened the letter up, and I was like, "Thank God I didn't send it, because this is not. There's so much more I can say. I see my side so much more now. You know, I can be genuine and authentic now." And I wrote this letter to her, and I sent it, and I didn't hear anything back from her. But I just knew that, okay, well, hopefully she got it. And then about 2 months ago, 10 o'clock at night on a Monday, I got a phone call on my phone. And I knew exactly what number that was, because she was the only number I ever memorized. And I was like, wow, she's calling me. And then I was like, oh, man, I can't deal with this. It's 10 o'clock on a Monday. I'm going to go to bed. It was a long day. But you know what? I let it go to voicemail, and I listened to her voicemail, and she said, you know, I've been meaning to call you for a very long time. I have your letter, and it was such a beautifully written letter, and I'd love to talk to you if you could give me a call back sometime. I hope to hear from you. And I called her right back after that, and we had a long conversation. And, you know, I need to clean my side of the street up in my amends, but oftentimes, and I, you know, my sponsor said to me, and I tell the women that I sponsor, is like, you have to put into account that those people are probably going through a lot of pain too. And, you know, you make an amends to them, you're helping relieve some of their grief and what they've gone through and what you've done to them, you know. And we talked for 2 hours, and it was like we had never stopped talking. And she told me a little bit about what happened after her mom died, and, you know, her process of grief and what she was doing now. And it was just such a really healing conversation, and not one that I ever thought was going to happen. And, you know, at the end of the conversation, she said, I'd really like for us to, like, start a new friendship. Would you be interested in that? And I said, absolutely. And I'm not capable of that on my own. You know, I don't do those types of things. You know, I have to listen to a sponsor. I have to pray, and I have to be of service to other people. And I was able to have that conversation with her, and I got my friend back. You know, we talked on Thanksgiving, you know, and that's what this program does. My first authentic relationship and has started with my sponsor. You know, she loves me. She's really, really tough, but she cares about me. And I've been able to learn how to be in a relationship with other people through her, you know. And got a few more minutes. I'll tell a little story. I love, like, doing stuff like this, but, you know, a lot of times, you know, we've gone down to, like, roundups and, you know, things like that. And I think it was 2015 was the AA World Conference in Atlanta. And, you know, we went down there, and it's like 4 days worth of all these meetings. And there's like people, you know, people that go to those things are like really on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they like want to be there. And like, it was so cool to be in, there was 80,000 people, and there was people from all over the world. And the last night of the conference, they have this big meeting in this auditorium. It's the where the basketball team plays. I can't remember the name of it, in Atlanta. And 80,000 people in this arena. And, you know, they're playing, like all these, like, fun songs. And, like, the meeting started. And this portion of the meeting was about, I think it was 15 people that had over 50 years of sobriety. And there's they each have a number. And they pick, probably like 20 people. They pick 10 people to go up and share for 5 minutes their experience, you know, five minutes to share a little bit of whatever it is they want to talk about, you know. And this guy, he gets picked, and he goes up there, and he's been sober for like 60 plus years. He's probably 90 years old or something like that. And he's still got it, you know, and he goes up and he introduces himself. He says what his sobriety date is. He says he has a sponsor. And then he just started laughing, like laughter. And everybody's like starts chuckling. And then he calms down, and then he goes to try and speak again, and he just starts laughing. And for 5 minutes, this man laughed, and the whole auditorium laughed. And I don't think he had to say but one word. That's what 50 plus years of sobriety gives you. And in that moment, I think everybody in that auditorium wondered what that man had, you know? And, you know, I mean, you know, and that laughter has been explained to me is a laughter that only God can create. And I've gotten a chance to experience that over my years, my short time in sobriety. You know, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love my sobriety. And with that, thank you for having me, Billy. And thanks to you for letting me share. I'm an alcoholic.